Welcome back, everyone. I'm Don Furst. I'm the pension fellow at the Academy. This panel is on maximizing efficiency, the third principle that we're discussing this afternoon. We've got two of our regulars up here, speakers from this morning, Rocky Joyner and Rob Wiley, and we're joined by Bruce Cadenhead. Bruce is the vice chair of our Pension Practice Council and also was quite a participant in the development of the AGES monograph. So the efficiency principle is one that everyone tends to support. It's just wonderful to have an efficient retirement system. But what does that mean, and how do we attain it? And what kind of trade-offs are there to get such a system? One of the first things that we look at in maximizing retirement income, making sure that the money is used to produce the greatest retirement income for people, is lowering plan costs, trying to encourage economies of scale. One of the ways we've talked about possibly doing that is encouraging larger plans, regional plans, that any employer can join, particularly to help small employers accomplish these economies of scale. Standardizing fees is an idea that's been discussed, particularly investment fees and how investment fees would be charged, and ensuring that fees are fully transparent. Now, these are not without controversy either, because there are many people who say that outstanding performance should be rewarded with higher fees and that you get what you pay for. So there's a lot of issues in how you actually maximize this and get the most value for what the fees or the costs of the plan are. Another element of efficiency is broadening the participation of plans, having as many people participate as possible, and having them participate as much as possible throughout their entire working career. So the earlier people start to save or participate in a retirement plan, whatever type it is, the more retirement income that plan will produce for them. So having broad coverage and early coverage, participation in the system will encourage efficiencies. Minimizing leakage is another important concept. Making sure that the money that's designated for retirement savings or retirement income eventually is actually used for that. So leakage constitutes a couple different ways that happens. During working career, people change jobs sometimes, take lump sum distributions, don't necessarily reinvest in an IRA or roll it into the next employer's plan. People take hardship withdrawals also from plans. That's a form of leakage, although many times that's potentially repaid. Loans from plans are another potential form of leakage, particularly when they don't get repaid when you change employment. Another type of leakage from the system really happens in retirement, in the payout phase, and that's when, particularly with defined contribution plans or wealth accumulation plans, where people start to draw out the capital gradually. When they die, there's still a lot of capital left. It's usually transferred to another generation. Transferring to a spouse is not really leakage, because that's providing retirement income for the spouse also. But to the extent that large amounts are not used to produce income for the retiree or the retiree's spouse and they're transferred to another generation, that might meet the needs or the desires of the participant, but we have to recognize that it's not necessarily the most efficient way to provide retirement income. Now, a lot of times the trade-off on that is whose money is it really, and what are they trying to do with it? So particularly in individual account plans where employees save their own money, they may want to transfer that to another generation, to their heirs. That may be their desire rather than producing retirement income. In that regard, we just have to recognize that we're providing a tax subsidy to that in the form of tax-sheltered income on those funds during a certain time period, and ostensibly the idea for that tax benefit is retirement income, not transfer of assets to another generation. So we have to recognize that and consider what are the trade-offs in allowing these types of things. Pooling risk is another way to make plans very efficient in providing, again, in providing retirement income as opposed to other objectives that you might have with wealth accumulation. Encouraging multiple forms of distribution, including some of the things Mark mentioned at lunchtime. Decisions don't always have to be all or nothing. You can choose partial distributions in different forms. You might be able to manage the longevity risk better in that regard. There are multiple ways to manage longevity risk also. We can consider immediate annuities, fixed and variable income type of annuities, and also partial annuitization and longevity annuities. So rather than immediate annuities, purchasing a deeply deferred annuity and managing distributions from a defined contribution account in the meantime. So multiple ways to manage some of these risks. One of the things I am always keen on is limiting guarantees to what's really needed to be guaranteed. Guarantees are expensive. It's not inexpensive at all to guarantee anything. So particularly when you're talking about lifetime income, the guarantee is longevity, the guarantee is investment return, and the guarantee is expenses also to some extent. How much of that truly needs to be guaranteed, and one of the things that many of the shared risk plans we've talked about will guarantee a lifetime income, but it isn't an absolute guarantee that the amount will always be the same. It might go up if investment results are very good. It might go down if experience is not so good. So keeping the level of guarantees to an appropriate level is another way to make a plan more efficient. Narrowing the variability of outcomes is another way to make sure that the targeted level of retirement income is attained. Usually this involves reducing the amount of risk in a portfolio as you approach retirement. Again, this is much more important in individual account plans as opposed to large defined benefit plans of some of the types that we've looked at. Stressing the reliability and consistency of income, recognizing what your target is, really helps people plan for what they're going to have in retirement and knowing what that's going to be. So that's another way of increasing the efficiency of things. So what we'd like to do is just raise a number of questions now about these things, have our panelists respond, and hopefully encourage all of you to comment on some of these questions too, or raise additional questions if you have any. So I'd like to turn to the panelists and ask their thoughts about some of these issues on efficiency. Let's start this morning or this afternoon with the issue of the size of plans that we've talked about and economies of scale. Most of the plans that we talked about this morning were pretty large systems and encompassing either lots of employees or somehow creating economies of scale through participation of, say, many small employers. Do you gentlemen think that's the only way to do things, or are there ways that we can encourage economies in small plans and encourage small plans more also? Is it strictly a size issue, or how can we get some of these economies of scale?
You want to start, Rocky?
Sure. A lot of it is a size issue for certain factors. You have to have the infrastructure to do the bookkeeping, the administration. Those things cost money, and a small plan is going to have difficulty with it. By the same token, for example, the Georgia Municipal Plan that I mentioned earlier, you have 280 cities across the state. Some of these cities have one or two employees, but this particular structure allows them the full breadth of a DB plan because it's monitored, handled, invested by somebody else on the overstructure, but it's still their plan, it's their money. So that's kind of a structure that gives a little bit of both, a little bit of individuality at the same time giving that depth of resources you have to use. The other thing we've noticed around the country, particularly with on the multi-employer side, is you have the unions are smaller, particularly in construction, and so they're joining forces for economies of scale. So they're actually doing it in the private sector also, not just the public sector.
Yeah, and of course we're limited in the private sector to certain, you know, to multi-employer. Get a lot of questions from clients. What about a multiple employer plan, or creating a joint venture? Can we just throw them in our plan? Can we get together with others? I think from an efficiency point of view, that would be a great idea. Mm-hmm. Same thing, you build up a large base where you can meet these expenses. Unfortunately, the way that we have the rules set up right now, it's not really practical. And so I think we want to look at the things that we can do in the rules, the way the contributions are determined, the way assets are allocated, the complicated calculations that underlie that I think don't really serve any useful purpose, but they certainly get in the way of creating this kind of economy of scale. We're right now looking at some ideas or some suggestions for modifying that either legislatively or through changes to regulation.
Virtually Rob? All of the statewide plans have gone to the model of consolidation as much as possible, and some places have more economies of scale than others, but we all also offer what would be a certain amount of flexibility in offering choice in voluntary plans. Mm-hmm. Lots of times combined where you have a foundation plan and then a variable plan above that, and it'd be great to see things like Secure Choice and USA both opening up to the private sector. Maybe on the public side, we've kind of taken a direction that's specific to consolidation, but on the private side, the USA model and the Secure Choice both seem very responsible.
Okay. One of the things where the plans from this morning differ a little bit, the South Dakota plan and the New Brunswick plan cover essentially all the employees that are employed and in the system, whereas both the Secure Choice and the USA retirement plans are voluntary and allow people to opt out even if they have automatic enrollment. How do you think that difference in participation is really going to affect the efficiencies of the plans?
Go ahead.
For Secure Choice, for example, that's an issue. We've looked at that. And in one particular state, I think the number of completely uncovered retirement folks was about 2 million of the workforce. No retirement system at all. And we were thinking if we could just get 1 to 5% of those folks, you still have a fairly large DB plan of 10,000, 20,000 people. So if you had that, you still have enough there of a corpus to have some economies of scale. But you could throw it out there. If nobody comes to the dance, then you got a big empty room with nothing going on. So that can be a real issue.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I would just add, certainly you look at it from the perspective of the plan, and you can set up these systems and get the plan to be big enough to be efficient. But from the kind of broader societal perspective, the fact that you're leaving out so many people, if you think of the retirement system as a whole or the gaps in the system and how the retirement needs of the uncovered people are being met, that I think can't help but be inefficient. And so the more that you can close that gap, necessarily, I think you'll become more efficient.
My only comment would be is, from my experience, if you can build the auto enrollment into mm-hmm. some of that, is particularly helpful in getting that participation.
Yeah, if I may add, on the Secure Choice, particularly in California, they also looked at the delivery system of how you get the word out there and trying to get some of the small vendors in towns all across the state to be a part of that. And that's just going to be crucial in getting those things up and running.
When we talk about minimizing leakage in the system, In the pure DB models, it's pretty easy because there just isn't much leakage because there aren't any pre-retirement distributions of any forms. But in most of the individual account plans where individuals are saving their own money, individuals sometimes have some serious needs before retirement for funds, whether it's hardship, unemployment, severe medical problems, disability. Lots of different things can happen. How can the plans balance these needs of people for access to what they consider their own money with the desire to maximize efficiency by saying, no, we can't have leakage in this. It's got to go to retirement. What do you think are ways that we can balance that or manage those conflicting needs?
So I had a thought on this, and Paul's mentioned earlier of investing in gold reminded me of something my brother told me a while back, where sometime in the 1990s he was convinced that we were going to have some great financial catastrophe. I think he was off by about 15 years, but he went out and invested in gold, and at the same time he had incurred quite a bit of credit card debt. And then he met his now wife, and she said, "This is crazy. Sell the gold, pay off the credit card debt, you'd be much better off." And of course he was. But you know, life interferes. You have other needs, probably especially earlier in your career. And does it make sense to kind of enforce this discipline of setting aside money for retirement at the same time that you still have a student loan debt, or that you're racking up credit card debt, or you have medical bills or other things? And so I was thinking of maybe there's a way to incorporate the mechanisms that we have within retirement savings systems to handle that. And it might require a little bit more of advice to the individual, or you could set up some kind of a program where, let's say normally you would set aside, you know, 6% of pay, 10% of pay, whatever it is, towards retirement, but you have these other more compelling needs, and it's really inefficient to put retirement ahead of credit card debt. But maybe you could use the same structure to say, all right, you've gotten yourself into a situation, we'll use this payroll withholding mechanism, and we will allocate some amount towards extinguishing this other debt while maybe a little bit goes towards retirement, and it's just going to continue automatically. Once that debt is paid off, the money keeps going, and then it goes towards retirement, and you kind of set that up in advance instead of relying on the individual to make sensible decisions at various stages along the way. So just an idea as I was listening this morning that I thought maybe you could build in to address this leakage problem.
Just to add to what he said, you're right. It's got to be a holistic approach. I mean, there may be some of these things we're giving, letting them take their 401k money for, that they might have a better source of funds to use to do that instead of the retirement plan. I mean, there are insurance products. Maybe we should have more education about using insurance products for certain things. But it is a hard balancing act. We recognize that, but it has to be balanced. The other thought might be just early in your career, I mean, step up the contribution rates. Low amounts early, add them on, so if you steal from yourself in your 30s, you're not hurting yourself quite as badly, but I don't know. It's a tougher question than just right now.
Okay.
I'm tempted to say something, but I didn't save any money when I was 25 years old. I don't know why. I get on my kids to do it now, but it's a tough thing to do, being able to manage that money as a young person. There's a lot of things going on there. So I don't envy that question if you're personally having to deal with it.
Yeah, I don't think it's a question of how do we just eliminate leakage, because when it is the individual's funds, there are some very justified needs for getting to those funds at some point. It's more a question of how do we minimize and make the right incentives, or how do we have sufficient savings or ways to deal with those other hardships that come up?
If I may, you and I, when we were young, our employer had a DB plan that we didn't have to contribute to.
That's right.
We didn't have to worry about it that much because somebody else was looking after us. Now nobody's looking after you. So we got it's like you said, greater education than it ever used to be because you're on your own.
Any great ideas from the audience about how to do this? John?
John Turner, Pension Policy Center. I wanted to ask something which I thought was very interesting that you said about efficiency, and that is limiting tax incentives for retirement so that the money is used for retirement and not for estate building. And relating to this is the issue of some individuals having very large accumulations in their IRAs. And it came out during the presidential election that Romney had maybe $87 million in his IRA. And I published a study in the Journal of Retirement where we found that there was one plan that filed a Form 5500 with two participants and $550 million in that. And so I just wanted to get the feedback of the panel as one way of improving the efficiency of the retirement system, setting a cap on the maximum amount that could be accumulated in an individual account plan, so to be just for retirement purposes, not for wealth purposes.
And we should probably mention that there was a proposal in the administration's budget this past year to, I don't think it was just individual account plans, but I think it was to put a cap on the total of all plans of roughly 3 million, although it was related to retirement income and would vary with interest rates, but it was said to be about 3 million, I think, in the current interest rate environment. So do you think a cap like that would be effective?
We don't have anybody with balances like that. almost to the person in the whole plan, we don't meet the maximums on contributions or the maximums on benefit payments. We haven't had to struggle with that so much. Rocky, maybe you're running into more of those folks than we are, but we haven't ran up against that wall virtually at all.
I see where you're coming from, and there's some validity to that, because you want money put in IRAs and 401ks to be used for retirement. You don't want them to use to pass on as an estate to the kids coming behind you necessarily. By the same token, how do you put that cap on it? Where do you make it? Because people have different levels of income, different needs. We also, one other area that we just do not save for is long-term care insurance for the end of life, which is going to be a big chunk of money at the end of the day. And some of us who have actually thought about it, some of our 401k is planned to be kept aside for that at the end of the day. So it's the concept is good, and maybe we work through it a little harder, but it has to, again, like everything else we talked about, holistic in nature, make sure the limit's not, we're not straitjacketing somebody from something that's legitimate.
Hey, Don, Eli Greenblum, that 3 million isn't really that much. Many of the actuaries in the room who spent years in the 80s and 90s dealing with fractions or decimals like 1.4 and 1.25, you remember those? Well, this is less than that, because that includes the DB. So if you maxed out on your DB at the 415 limit, there's not much more that you can have in a DC account, that cap.
Yeah, I certainly didn't mean to indicate that I was promoting that. I just wanted to mention it because it's in the playground. I think some of the other, to keep it balanced, some of the other objections to that type of an idea are first of all, let's say you did get the limit at a level that most people would say, yeah, that's enough, and above that might be abusive. Combining the DB and DC make it very difficult to administer, and that those limits are going to change. The other aspect that I know there will be a lot of pushback from segments of our industry is, a lot of small plans, the owners or proprietors of the plans end up accumulating a lot of money like that in their plans, but in order to do so, they have to extend coverage to all their other employees. And they might, if they couldn't, if one of the arguments is if they couldn't accumulate a lot of money, they probably wouldn't have the plan at all and might not have it for the rest of the employees. So it is something that would have some effect on coverage, too, in addition. So I think that's actually a very complicated issue with all the different factors that you have to weigh into how it works. Another comment?
Yeah, I'll introduce one more complicating question. And I guess I've been thinking about this. It seems that one of the challenges in thinking through this is, I guess I call it the seduction of how we think about cost. And we define cost in either terms of management fees, or we counter it with the idea of some assumed investment return. And in both cases, what we're really missing, and is it, I think, highlighted here, is the cost of volatility. And I think earlier, that's kind of what I was trying to get at, is how do we communicate the cost of volatility? Because that's really what's driving some of the poor experience that we've seen, is that cost of volatility is not really being priced in or communicated. And I think as we think about the efficiency part of it, it's not just getting everybody say, well, you should just charge 0.5% and everybody has to, that's what you pay. It's like, well, wait a minute, what kind of risk are you taking and how do I understand what that means, because there's a real cost to that as well.
Right. Thank you. Okay, here's another issue that's come up. Again, most of the plans that we talked about this morning and a lot of the proposals that come from people that think a lot about these issues involve very little investment discretion for the individuals. That many of the plans say that should be professionally managed and allocated and things. But yet it's a voluntary system and it's employees' money that's going into this. How do we handle the trade-off between the individual's their desire to manage their own money versus the efficiency that might be attained by having them not do it and having it professionally managed? Or how do you sell that idea, particularly in individual account plans?
Well, from a secure choice viewpoint, and I'll just speak to that one because it's easier. The targeted group, they're not saving anything. So it's not like they're investing or have a choice or anything. They have nothing. So the concept there is to get them in the game. Now, if they then develop an account that's large enough and they say, this is kind of interesting, I'd like to learn more about this and handle my own, then they can move it into their own IRA, their own structure. But that group, I think if you did the open investing type thing for them, you defeat the purpose of the whole thing.
And I'm wondering really, you know, how much of a desire is there? You know, we saw that before there were the current default options and when auto enrollment and auto escalation weren't viable options, and people didn't make very good choices and people left things alone and you know, showed other signs that they weren't really very interested in taking on that responsibility. And so now we have better mechanisms. And in most of these cases, or I think all these cases, the individual still has the opportunity to take that on. You know, just from personal experience, you know, my wife keeps saying, you know, we've got this money sitting here, what are you going to do with it? And I'll get to that later when I'm a little less busy. So, I can imagine all the other people out there who would just like to have a lot of that taken care of for them, change over time with the default options, the age-based options. I think we're moving in the right direction on that kind of thing.
I'm with you completely, Bruce. Everything that's mandatory contributions for us is always managed by the professionals. Everything that's voluntary is managed by the individual. We've moved to the target dates and the other what would be maybe hybrid investment alternatives for these folks. But interestingly enough, the question we probably get more than anything else is, can't you manage this for us? Can't you do it for me? My work is such that I don't have time to be working on this. I don't understand the markets well enough. Can't you help me more?
And why can't we? Many companies don't want to take on the fiduciary responsibility of determining that asset allocation because they perceive some liability to that. How can we make stronger defaults toward professional investment management? Or we have the regulations where the employer, if you offer the right alternatives to people, that you have no responsibility for the asset allocation. They make all their own choices. But if you take that over and have default decisions for them, are you changing that, or how can we get around that and still not put too much liability on the plan sponsor? Anybody else have any ideas about that?
Henry Eichelberg with General Dynamics. You know, Don, I think you guys are on the right approach from the leakage standpoint. More people lose more money taking it out to buy a truck or a bass boat than they do with a bad investment. Most people that don't know what to do essentially don't do anything. So when you look at their funding profile, it's all in the lowest risk investment, something that maybe we defaulted them in, and now most employers are starting to default people into target date funds, and I think that over time will help a lot. The question will be fundamentally, at least on the individual account plans, if they can get access to it, under what circumstances should they be able to? Because you don't have to offer loans, you don't have to offer hardships, but it does reduce people's desire to participate in the plan, because they feel like their money is now being locked up for a period of time.
Great, thank you, Henry.
And I think, Don, I agree we're moving in the right direction on the accumulation phase. I think where employers are still a lot more reluctant to get involved is on the spend down phase once you retire. I think that's where individuals and account plans need the most help, but I think, you know, we're not at a stage where the rules facilitate the employer getting involved in helping people make thoughtful decisions on how to make that money last for a lifetime.
So let's talk about that lifetime issue a little bit and the annuitization issue, which is a big one, especially to actuaries. We recognize that there's some real value that's created by pooling longevity risk and paying out over lifetime income. As I've mentioned before, it doesn't have to be in a guaranteed fixed annuity. There's a number of ways to do this. It can be in variable annuities. It can be in longevity annuities, deferred annuities. So there's various ways to do that. But they're so hard for people to actually choose those. Should some portion of the benefit be required to be distributed as an annuity? Is that a way to get more? It's obviously a way to get more efficiency in terms of retirement income. But is it worth the trade-off of telling people what they have to do with their money?
Our experience has been that most of the time they're really happy for us to give them some, I don't want to call it advice, but give them some input. In our retirement income management seminars that we do in workshops, we do a number of reviews and case studies and examples, and one of those is using a portion of your accumulations to annuitize at least a part of what you have in your accounts. And many times I think that's received pretty well, but it really is hard to get people to pull the trigger on some of that sometimes.
But you said something very interesting. You said, should we force annuitization? Or your question was, should we force annuitization in a certain portion of it anyway? My response would be, why not? It's a tax issue. We're given a tax breaks for this money. We want the money to go to what it's supposed to go for. If you save money for college education and end up not using it for college education, as I understand, you get an extra tax hit because you didn't use it for the right purpose. So I think you have the same mindset here. We're designing policy to encourage people to behave in the way that society wants them to behave. And so do it.
I'd be very curious to see what kind of experience we get once we get the final regulations on longevity insurance, where you can present another choice to participants other than, you know, the example before was $1 million lump sum or $70,000 a year or something else that looks very unattractive. But if you can present a third option where you set aside some relatively small portion, kicks in at what looks like a reasonable amount of income later in life, and then you've got the rest of the money to deal with. You know, would we have to go to the step of making that mandatory? Might we want to? Well, maybe we would, but we don't yet have the experience of people, at least on a widespread basis, being confronted with that choice.
Okay. Anne?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about whether or not it's all annuitization or partial annuitization, similar to what, you know, Mark was talking about at lunchtime. And I always think about the fact that I remember when I was a consultant and I was dealing with a client who was subject to benefit restrictions, and we had these employee meetings, and we were explaining to them that they could only get half of their benefit in the form of a lump sum, and the other half had to be in an annuity until the plan got to be better funded. And one of the most common questions that we were asked is this going to be permanent? Can we have this forever? So I think that they certainly would like a little bit more options available to them than just all or nothing.
Don? Don, I had the same experience as Ann. Actually, we were able to help the client navigate so that they never hit the lump sum restriction. But in the same token, they said, well, we want that in our plan. We want the 50% in our plan, and they did that. I think that there should be like a second default in a DB plan that pays a lump sum. The first is just the regular annuity. The second would be, say, a longevity annuity, that you have to also sign off that you don't want a benefit that's equivalent to the annuity you could get for life, but you don't have to start taking that until, say, 80, 85, whatever life expectancy says is, you know, roughly your life expectancy. And that doesn't cost very much. So you still get maybe 80, 85% of the lump sum, and you get this small tail annuity. And you should, I think you should have to sign something saying you don't want that default. And I think you could do the same thing in a DC or 401k plan. You could say you have to default your way, you have to overcome the default to take the longevity annuity. I think that would be a good first step, and hope Treasury will consider that.
That's an interesting idea.
Yes. One of the panelists is talking about having to look at the whole picture. And I like the idea of allowing people choices, but the problem with a mandatory annuity, just looking at my own career, I've had three significant jobs. I would be really in trouble, since the federal government has given me a nice pension, if some of my other jobs force annuitization on me, because I want that money to spend as I want to. So it sounds good if you're only in one plan and this one plan is controlling your income, but in the real world, many of us have a lot of little pieces, and mandatory becomes a real issue. I like the idea of choice, I like the idea of deferral, but again, I think mandatory may cause as many problems as it solves.
Okay, thank you. Okay, John, one more comment.
I just wanted to comment about longevity insurance annuities and pension plans, and something that nobody has mentioned so far today, but I think is very important, is that the annuities provided by pension plans are unisex annuities. And this is particularly important for longevity insurance annuities, that there's a big difference. You know, the difference is not so great if you take an annuity at 62, but if you take a deferred annuity at 85, the unisex aspect becomes very significant. So I think you could never require or even make that as a default. In fact, I think it's a mistake even to indicate that it would be a good idea for men to take an annuity that way.
Okay, one last question I want to raise, because we're running a little short on time here on our session. There was one thing that was music to my ears this morning, and probably to a lot of other actuaries in the room, when someone was talking about requiring stress testing and lots of extra modeling and everything. Boy, the fees we could run up as actuaries on that would be amazing. And that raises the immediate question. I want to give Rob a chance to answer this, since you're directly in the line in that. There's so many things that you can do to improve the management of a retirement plan. How do you manage the trade-off that it would be very inefficient if you did everything the actuaries proposed to you? How do you determine what's really cost-effective versus what's just satisfying your intellectual curiosity and managing these plans well?
Realistically, our budgets, our human resources, the ability for you as a staff to be able to absorb that data and make it useful, whether or not you can afford to pay for it. And, you know, when it comes down to the end, sometimes data overload can be a confusing factor for particularly, and we've talked about our boards, many are lay boards, a level of communication and information is great, but it is possible to go beyond a spot where you really can communicate it well to so that they understand it and can recognize the value. And so I think you end up finding kind of the break-even points or the sweet spot maybe in some of that, just, budgets affect it, but you also, sometimes you just have to be able to tell when it's just going to be too much, when it's going to go over people's heads a little bit, and it happens occasionally that way, but there is a little bit of a sweet spot, I think, for most of us in some of that information.
Okay, thank you very much.